Hello and welcome to another programme in the series Collective Wisdoms with myself, Caroline Brennan. Now, this is the series where each week I speak to a different creative person who shares their reasons for working towards making a difference. Now, this week I have travelled across Dublin city centre and I find myself in a wonderful garden on the south side of Dublin. And to be honest, I think the only interruptions I'm going to get in the next half an hour would probably be the sound of the birds making song here at the face of the midday sun. And why am I here today? Well, this beautiful garden was created with tenderness and understanding by my guest today. He is psychiatrist and lobbyist, Dr. Michael Corrie.
I had two very powerful parents. My father came from County Clare, a thatched cottage, literally, in Cranny, of strong Republican background. So from a very early age, my father would have been involved in the IRA and in the various campaigns, the War of Independence, the Black and Tans, all of these wars. But he had very strong views about peace and even used to talk that perhaps 1916 wasn't a good idea, that it perhaps was premature, that perhaps we should have waited and possibly home rule. So it was ironic, he was actually a pacifist, was very interested in horses and bred horses and rode, was a very good horseman, loved farming, loved nature, loved trees, just a very interesting man. My mother, by contrast, came from a very wealthy background, Protestant stock, Northern Ireland. So there was a huge collision of cultures between Republican, basically peasant background, and this aristocratic lady who originally, her family would have come from Belgium and connections to the royal family there.
And Michael, I mean, the clash of the two cultures you describe, your mum and your dad, how did they actually come about to meet?
Through horses. Horses are the great leveller. My mother was a good horsewoman, hunted, rode side saddle. My father would have been a very good horseman, hunted, jumped for a while with the equitation school. And just, yeah, the love of animals, the love of nature would have brought them together. I always knew that I was different, that I could see the bigger picture. I had a tremendous sense of justice, a fair play. Would have been very aware as a small child about Africa. For some reason, Africa played a huge part in my life as a child, the black baby phenomenon. And I always vowed that if ever I became an adult, that I would find some way of contributing to Africa, which in fact is what I did. I was the youngest of eight, and I think by the time my parents came to me, they would have been quite tired of children. They would have had their difficulties relative to issues of class. And I would have seen as a kid the nonsense of class, the rich-poor divide. In fact, we originally lived possibly one of the nicest houses in this country called Seafield. Seafield is now known as Seafield House, designed by Cecil A Lovett Pierce, who designed the GPO out in Donabate, absolutely extraordinary house, with clock towers, courtyards, statues, pleasure grounds, peacocks. That house was sold, and then Altamont was bought, and the Billows was bought at the same time. So it meant also that because the houses were big, that there would have been staff. So I couldn't understand why. I was very close to one of the staff. He was Italian, William Maringo, Billy, we used to call him. And I'd be stunned, you know, and upset how Billy couldn't join us at the table to eat. Literally, Billy was like my father at times. He was the one that would have bought the best presents at Christmas time. He was the one that bought the Beano and the Topper and the Dandy and bought the gimmicks and, you know, stuff that was made in China, which would probably break down in a couple of days. But he was a beautiful man, and any of the people we ever had any contact with were nice. Like the Billies of the world, the maids were really nice people, and I didn't see a divide. And I think my father was quite uneasy about that. But from my mother's world, that was the way it operated. So from a very early age, I was a witness to this divide where my mother would value people on a weighing scale of their class, their status, their accent, the way they dressed, what they... It was very noticeable as a small child that people were being weighed up on a valued system that didn't seem to be fair. So I actually felt for a long time that I was a stranger in this family. I actually thought I was adopted. I remember finding an old suitcase and knowing that this was obviously where files were kept, and actually looking to find actually my birth cert, and being relieved that I actually was in fact a member of the family, because I actually didn't really fit in. I actually thought, and this is a strange one, but I actually thought that I was an angelic being, and I would sometimes look around the house at holy pictures, because there was some nice artwork in the various houses. And in those days, they had beautiful little paintings of, you know, around the edges of maybe a painting of the Madonna. They would have lovely little, like, cherubs and really... And I would be looking to see, could I recognize myself or one of them? I immediately, you know, joined the choir and became an altar boy, very much in the quest for some lost world, and would have had a vocation, you know, for the priesthood or becoming a monk. I just had this sense that if we are spiritual beings, which I've always reckoned, you know, we're spiritual beings having human experiences, why not develop that? Why not develop the spirituality? But as a small child, with a child's logic, you felt, well, if we are spiritual beings, why do we not develop this? What's all this nonsense about upper class, lower class, about wealth? Why are my parents, like, living this life in entertainment and people coming? And I would know, just from listening, that obviously there was a cost to that. It was expensive running houses. And I just felt like, you know, why not, like, sell everything and live, like, in a thatched cottage.
And so you said that you considered the possibility of monastic life. Mm. Was that something that came to fruition, or did you choose a different path?
I went to a boarding school in County Waterford, and I found it very difficult to fit in there. My father sold the house in Dundrum, Altamont, and moved to Kilkee, and it was more about him than us. The fact that I was 11 and I would have liked to have stayed on in Dundrum, that's where my friends were, and to have gone to the local secondary school. So that was never factored in. And I was shipped down to this boarding school, and it was very difficult because people had different valued systems to me. It wasn't very fair the way things were run. There was a lot of brutality, a lot of very bad beatings. It was nothing to get slapped 6 times on each hand with a cane, with a strap, to get boxed around the ears, to get knocked to the ground and kicked. The sexual abuse came in the form of, they used to have visiting priests who would come and run retreats. And it was the usual fire and brimstone. And I was very young going to school. I was only 11. So even a lot of what these retreat people would be talking about was over my head. They were talking about, you know, masturbation and bad thoughts. And I really hadn't entered that world yet. I was still quite innocent. And when I did become aware myself of sexual feelings and masturbation, and just the high stakes that they were involved in those days, that if you died in a state of mortal sin, you went to hell if you had a bad thought or an impure action. And that's a very heavy load to place on kids, and particularly on me. I found it really unfair. And I remember being quite worried about all of that. And there was one particular year, I was probably about 13, 14, actually going to have my confession heard by the priest that was running the retreat in the parlour. Because there was a sense that if you went to the confessional box, it was quite informal. And I remember figuring out, because this man came across as really nice, hell's fire stuff, but at the same time quite nice, I thought maybe it might be an opportunity for me maybe to just talk out some of these issues. And to my horror, he molested me, opened my fly and felt my genitalia, and whatever way I responded or recoiled, he stopped. And I remember disengaging as quickly as possible and leaving that parlour. And as I was walking out, there was a door open into a bedroom. And I remember thinking, oh my God, you know, I could have ended up there. And of course, you never talked about these things. It was only years later, when I went back to our reunion, that I decided I'd actually go around and ask people, were they actually abused by this guy? And it turned out there were large numbers where he had the full Monty, anally penetrated and oral sex. So we went as a group to the president of the college and said, like, have this guy removed. So obviously that particular incident was a turning point for me. I decided, oh my God, is this what is going on? And that particular incident for me was a turning point. Huge line in the sand, and created then all kinds of difficulties for me, because if I wasn't going to be a priest or I wasn't going to be part of the religious culture, what was I going to do?
Well, Michael did find another vocation. He became a medical doctor, and after qualifying, he kept his promise that he had made to himself as a little boy. He went to work in Africa, and he practiced in Uganda during the infamous reign of Idi Amin. So how significant was Africa to him then and now? That's the question I put to him.
The Africans are possibly the most heart-centered people I have ever come across in my life. They live completely in their heart. They're unbelievably brilliant with their children. I mean, both men and women, they're fantastic mothers and fathers. And they make such perfect eye contact. They look you straight in the eye, and you know that you're connecting fully to this person that is connecting with you when you look at them. So energetically, it's very easy to be close to the Africans. I would think of Africa every day. A day would not go by and I wouldn't think of Africa. And I just love the fact that Africa is where we all came from. I came from there, and my DNA came out of there. So I felt very, very at home in Africa with the African people. And it used to be a surprise to me sometimes when I'd be palpating an abdomen of a pregnant lady to actually see my white hands on or I was percussing someone's back. I'd say, of course. But I just merged. You know, I've spent some time in India, very different energy, more mind and ego, where the African, it's more heart. Very, very hard. It's more love, more compassion. Yeah, and that's why it's very, very sad to see them involved in so much conflict now because of the arms trade and the weapons, and it's poor Africa's. It's bled dry, and we have contributed to it. It's very tragic, but just as a place to go. I brought my children out there a couple of years ago. I didn't want to go to Uganda. It still has too many traumatic memories for me. But I brought them to Tanzania and to Kenya. I brought the kids out to the Serengeti, and we were traveling in a jeep, and we stopped because the wildebeest were migrating. And the Serengeti, the Maasai call it the endless ocean. And it is an ocean. It's hard to describe its size. It's vast, flat. There's beautiful savanna grass blowing, and abundance of game. So we're watching the wildebeest migrating, and they were actually crossing the road, so we stopped, and there had been a kill by a lion of a zebra, because the zebra travel with the wildebeest. They're the ears, and they watch out for things, and the wildebeest sense the rain, so they travel almost in a symbiotic relationship together. So we had stopped and we were watching the kill, and there was a lightning storm away in the distance, and there was flamingos flying into a little lake. And I said to my youngest boy, I think he was 12 at the time, I said to Julian, do you think this works, all of what we're seeing now, do you think this works by human rules? And he just turned to me and said, Dad. And I said, isn't it true that if a wind came and blew us off the planet, and every human being as well, off the planet, this would still be going on? He said, exactly. And that was probably the most powerful teaching moment I've ever had with my kids, to be able to say, this consciousness, this life force, is bigger than us, and it's operative. And we can choose to tune into it or not.
Can I just ask you a general question? You talked about, there was too many traumatic memories for you. As a human being, traumatic memories, how have you managed to work through traumatic memories and maybe come out the other end, or maybe you haven't, I don't know?
The mind is this huge data bank that stores vast amounts of information. And the mind is not necessarily the place you go to seeking solutions to the difficulties of life, because it doesn't have the wisdom chips. Our mind is not programmed with the actual wisdom chips. I mean, the emotions predate the actual thinking part of the brain by hundreds and hundreds of millions of years. I mean, the emotional repertoire that is within us has never really been fully plumbed. And I think that's going to be the next great movement in consciousness, is that we're going to actually look and realize that we are sitting on millions upon hundreds of millions of years of feelings that are shared by animals, that are actually inside in us, instincts. And, you know, feelings are so important. Thoughts are one thing, but feelings are vital. I mean, if you were to go out and do a survey of people and ask them, what would they want most in life? They will say, I want to feel happy. I want to feel peaceful. It's a feeling. It's not a thought. We crave the feeling. And for me, I have been fascinated by heart consciousness, which to me is a different consciousness to the mind, because the mind is set up to be bipolar. By that I mean dualistic, opposites. You can't have right without left, you can't have up without down, you can't have white without black. Opposites, discriminatory. And that's vital for survival reasons. This is safe, this is not safe. This car is coming too fast, don't pull out. So the mind is very, very much to do with survival. And to me, it's an extension of the instinct to survive. I'm a little bit suspect about accessing that database to give me guidance, because it doesn't have the wisdom chips. Where the wisdom chips are is in my heart, because my heart is set up to be a place of oneness. Like, for instance, the heart is the place of non-judgment, compassion, balance, harmony, love, peace, spirit, soul. You don't have a good peace or a bad peace. There's only peace. So it's the place of oneness. So if you can access the energy of your heart, then you're truly doing something really, really powerful.
I don't necessarily think that all psychiatrists think the way you do. I'm wondering about the amount of reflexivity that they conduct in respect to learning from their clients. And certainly, like you said before, the systems constrain doctors. I mean, but doctors choose to live and operate within a particular system. In terms of modern day psychiatry, particularly in Ireland, let's just stay within the Irish context. I mean, you believe there needs to be some serious changes.
Oh, psychiatry in Ireland is at an all-time low. When I started psychiatry, I started with Professor Ivor Brown. Psychotherapy was so much part of what we were doing. It was so much part that when I got my basic degree in psychiatry, my membership degree, I went on and actually studied psychotherapy. And the idea of not going in the direction of psychotherapy was, it just seemed inappropriate.
Are you actually saying that there are psychiatrists out there who aren't trained as psychotherapists, even though their whole job is about listening to people and trying to in some way work through stuff with them?
There are over 300 consultant psychiatrists in this country, and I would say maybe 20, 25, 30 have qualifications in psychotherapy. It's the lack of scholarship in psychiatry that I find worrying, where if somebody comes, say, with depression, and the history is elaborated, and all the signs are there, yeah, this person is depressed, that's actually seen as a disease. And the person is treated accordingly, like as if you had a pneumonia or diabetes, and the person is given pills, and sometimes told that they'll have to stay on these pills for the rest of their lives. Where to me, what you're looking at when somebody has the symptoms of depression is the effect of a cause. There's a cause and effect relationship, and the cause of that person's depression lies in the way they have experienced life, how they've interfaced with life. Have they had a broken heart because of a relationship? Have they broken heart because somebody has died? Are they distressed because they may doubt their sexual orientation? Have they been bullied at work? Have they been sexually abused and something in the news is now triggering it? Were they abandoned as a child, and again something in their lives is resonating with that? So to me, there's always a cause, and to me, depression is an emotion. It's natural. There's a legitimacy to being depressed. I don't see anything as more urgent than how we look at the mind. And I think psychiatry, I think psychological medicine, counselling, psychotherapy, all the different schools, we have to change. We have to become so conscious of what actually we're dealing with. That when you're dealing with someone's mind, you're dealing virtually with their spirit, with their being, with their soul. And no matter how severe the disorder is, whether it's a psychotic disorder or a schizophrenic disorder or, you know, a panic disorder, they're not diseases. These are states that people grow into because of experiences. And for me, the tragedy is watching people spending years on medication, watching people not getting well, watching gazillions of pounds going down the drain in drugs, watching research money searching for a gene. Just, we have lost control, really, of how we should approach the mind.
Can I just ask, I mean, you're sitting here in front of me, and you're as calm and as collected, and I'm just watching your body language, just very, very relaxed. I mean, surely to God, you're not always that relaxed. And can you just give me maybe two aspects of what maybe your kids would say about Dad, that maybe Dad isn't so perfect after all? Or maybe you are.
Gosh, their dad has made many mistakes, and I'm sure my actions have impacted on their lives. But to be honest with you, I have a very, very simple answer to that, moment to moment to moment, I feel I'm doing the best I can with the resources available to me. I am not in the slightest bit judgmental of myself. I hold that for everybody. I think every human being deserves an Oscar for having done so well with their lives in the face of incredible difficulties. Where, yeah, I mean, you know, we give out more than we get back. I see people giving from the moment they wake up, giving to their children, driving them to schools, giving to their employers, giving to their employees, yielding in traffic, being kind. And at the end of the day, actually, you know, having given more than they have got back. And I see people who are doing all of that within relationships where there is no joy, where there is no love. And I personally, I'm in love with human beings. I think they are amazing. And I just think as a psychiatrist, I'm so privileged to be working with people at the level of consciousness. My sadness, and, you know, I feel very, very deeply. I mean, as I said, I could almost cry. I just feel so distressed that the service that people who are suffering from psychological distress are getting. It's a crime against humanity. It's ineffable. For me, I can't find the language to describe what is going down and what it means to future generations of people. Because if we continue with this approach of using drugs, of defining psychological distress as diseases, we're not ever going to come up with solutions. Because diseases have no meanings. Diseases do not have to be understood. So we're doing unspeakable damage. And I've set up this foundation called the Wellbeing Foundation with part of it called Protect Your Mind. And I mean protect your mind in the sense of education. What our kids are being taught in schools. How they themselves take on the responsibility of protecting their minds by certain ways of behaving and certain ways of thinking and certain ways of feelings. I have seen so much suffering, particularly when I was in Africa and visits to India and visits to South America. This is the worst I've ever seen, is the way the mind is being related to. It is, to me, it is the greatest tragedy of all time.
This series is kindly made with the support of Sound and Vision, which is a broadcasting funding scheme initiated by the Broadcasting Commission of Ireland.